Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, the holidays are almost upon us, and with it, the holiday giving season. And for the person who has most everything they need, you can't go wrong with a good book. So today we're joined by our book reviewer, Nancy Pearl, who shares her latest list of recommended reading. Nancy is a former librarian here in Tulsa and Seattle, where she now lives. Of course, she's been reviewing books for Studio Tulsa since this program's beginning in 1992. She's also the author of several books on recommended reading in her Book Lust series. Of course, you can also hear on NPR's Morning Edition. And most recently, she's been the editor for Amazon's Book Lust Rediscoveries series, which reprints her recommendations of some great out-of-print books that were first published from 1960 to 2000. And she joins us today with her latest list here on Studio Tulsa. Now, if you don't have a pen with you, that's fine. The list will be on our website at publicradiotulsa.org later today. Nancy Pearl is our guest. Nancy Pearl, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Rich.
Now, is this list sort of the best of the year or just the best you've read recently?
I would say a little bit of both.
Okay.
These are books that I really enjoyed and read over the course of the year.
You know, the holidays are coming up, and I assume most of these books will be great gifts.
They would be, and I'll point out who would be good recipients.
All right, well, let's just get started here. The first book on your list is by Ari Berman, Give Us the Ballot.
Ari Berman has written a history of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Of course, it's the 50th anniversary of that. We know a lot about the Civil Rights Act. There's been many histories about that, and we certainly know many details even about the Civil Rights Act. But I found that the Voting Rights Act has not been written about so much. And a lot of this book, even though I kind of knew the general outlines, it was an eye-opener to me. The hero of this book, if there can be a hero, is John Lewis. And John Lewis, the book opens on the day that John Roberts' Supreme Court really eviscerates the Voting Rights Act. And he is there in the court, and he was there at the beginning when he and his fellow supporters of the Voting Rights Act was trying to persuade President Johnson that this was the time to get that into law. So it's, you know, a little bit of history, but there's a lot of contemporary events. And I think that anyone who's interested in political science, who's interested in current events and what's happening now, I think this is a really important book, and it's one of those books, along with another book that we're going to talk about, that I think really can turn readers into activists.
Now, Berman, you mentioned he opens with the famous decision at the Supreme Court where Roberts, either from the bench or in his opinion, said, you know, the way we get rid of racial preferences is by not using racial preferences. And,
right.
This decision is still hotly debated in the wake of the decision about the actions of certain states in the South. And so this continues to be a very active political issue in certain parts of the country. Does he sort of give us a contemporaneous view of how the Voting Rights Act is not being enforced today, and as well as giving us the history of the act?
Absolutely. And much of the last part of the book focuses on North Carolina, which was one of the first states to take advantage of the change in the law to shut down places where rural people who are usually African American shut down places where they could register to vote to make it much harder to sign up to vote. And I think that what Ari Berman would say is that many states are doing their best, not just what we would think of as the Deep South states, but many states are doing their best to make it much more difficult for people of color to get the right to vote.
That's his viewpoint in the book?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I assume he talks about the history of getting this act enacted in the first place. I mean, that was perhaps as difficult as the Civil Rights Act.
It was in a way, and it wasn't, because with the Voting Rights Act, President Johnson really, against the advice of his closest aides and assistants, President Johnson insisted that this come up for a vote right after the Civil Rights Act. I mean, he saw the two as being so closely related that not to pass the Voting Rights Act would be a grave error.
The name of the book is Give Us the Ballot by Ari Berman. Up next is another one which still remains in the news today, and this has to do with the public schools, I assume. It's Dale Rusikow's The Prize. Who's in charge of America's schools?
Yes, so Dale Rusikow is a Washington Post reporter, the education reporter, and she got total access to the three major actors and all of the sub-players in Newark, New Jersey, when Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook donated $100 million to the state of New Jersey to fix the public schools in Newark. And because Newark was deemed a failing school system, it was taken over by the state. So Governor Chris Christie was in charge of the Newark schools. And Cory Booker, now the senator, one of the senators from New Jersey, was the mayor of Newark. So this, I call them the unholy triumvirate of Zuckerberg, Christie, and Booker, got together to try to radically disassemble and reassemble Newark schools using the business model, a kind of top-down model with cutting out tenure as much as they could, giving principals a great deal of latitude. And what I think Dale Rusikow shows so well in this book is that you can't fix schools without fixing some of the society's ills that are affecting the public schools. Charter schools do not fix the public schools. And she talks about the successes in Newark came from primarily the public schools, when you had a dedicated principal and dedicated teachers who knew that these kids came out of poverty. 80%, I think, some huge percentage of Newark school children qualify for free lunches. You know, and the fact that these kids live in a state of, they're suffering from PTSD, from trauma that arises out of the whole issue of poverty. It's a book that's minimally hopeful, especially to someone like a pessimist like me, and maximally sad, because the $100 million that Zuckerberg gave was then matched by another $100 million. And in the book, the author shows where that money went, and not a lot of it went directly to making the children's schools better.
Where did most of the money go to?
Administration.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't New Jersey, this experiment in Newark, geared towards minimizing public schools and creating more charter schools?
And, it was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did the charter schools perform any better, worse, or about the same as the public schools?
About the same.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that, you know, Christie and Cory Booker, who come from different political parties, are both, they're in the reformers camp, those people who want to reform the public schools by, and here's my own prejudice showing, basically shutting them down and setting up charter schools.
What were the bright spots? You said there were minimal bright spots.
Yeah, I guess the one major bright spot that stays in my mind is the example she gives of a public school and how the teachers and the principal are working together to get kids to school, to make sure that they get to school, to make sure that they are learning what they should be learning in class. I mean, in some cases, it's really a one-on-one kind of education, and it often has to be because these kids are having to overcome so much, often just even to get to school. It's, oh my gosh, it was a very moving book. But I do want to emphasize that both Ari Berman's Give Us the Ballot and The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools, are so readable. In both cases, you know, you don't realize when you're reading it that you're really learning a lot, if you will, or, you know, that you're taking in all this information. They're very readable and very accessible, and I think that's why they're so important.
Well, it sounds like both of those books are geared towards people who believe in equal opportunity and longtime institutions, whether it's a right to vote or the public schools movement.
Well, it's interesting to think of them together in that way, because it is the public schools and the public library are two of the last small d democratic institutions. You know, they're what make our democracy work.
Yeah. Up next is, I assume this is a novel by Mick Herron, right?
Yes, Mick Herron. I'm always so thrilled when I come across an author who writes thrillers that I haven't read before. And I had never even heard of Mick Herron, and here he is with, you know, five or six books. I was just thrilled. So Nobody Walks comes out in December, and it's a perfect, perfect gift for anyone who loves the kind of dark noir mysteries, which are so popular now. This is a standalone. That is, it doesn't yet appear to have a sequel coming, although I think that it's going to have a sequel coming. But it's the story of a man who has been living abroad away from England for many years and has been estranged from his now grown son for all of those years. And then he gets word that his son has been killed, and he decides to come back to England to try to find out who killed his son. I just loved this book. It's just fabulous.
A noir suspense thriller set in England.
Yes.
Well, that's kind of different. We expect more cozies out of England.
Yes, but when you go a little farther north.
Ah, yes, right.
They do get a little bit darker and darker and darker.
All right, and that's Nobody Walks by Mick Herron. Now, have you read any of his other books since then?
I have. He also has a series, two other series. The one that I quite enjoy is, well, the first one in that series is called Slow Horses, and the title is a pun, and it refers to a group of disgraced MI5 agents who are all shunted off out of the MI5 building, and they get a case to solve themselves, which it's much more satirical. It's a much lighter book than Nobody Walks.
All right. Well, today we're talking about Mick Herron's Nobody Walks with my guest today, our book reviewer, Nancy Pearl. She's a regular guest here on Studio Tulsa, talking about books every so often as we talk about books towards the end of the year with the idea of holiday giving just around the corner. Well, what's up next?
Well, next is a terrific series of very unusual, very original fantasy novels for older teens and adults. They're called the Ironmonger Trilogy, and the first one in that series is a book called Heap House, written by Edward Carey, who also did the fabulous illustrations in it. So the main character in this book is a teenager named Claude Ironmonger. And Claude Ironmonger lives at Heap House, which is a mansion at the center of the Heaps, outside, right outside of London. The Heaps is a huge pile of garbage, you know, lost items,
right,
discarded items that continually shift. So it's almost like living on an ocean of trash.
So it's a rubbish heap.
It is a rubbish, huge rubbish heap.
Okay.
And the Ironmongers have a tradition in their family that when an ironmonger is born, they are given a birth object. That is, they're given an object that they have to keep with them at all times. And Claude's object, the object he was given when he was born, is a bath plug. Do you remember those old rubber bath plugs with the metal
ring on the top? Yeah.
Right, right. And sometimes a little chain. Well, that's Claude's birth object. But something is weird, even weirder than that, which is that Claude thinks he can hear those birth objects whispering, and he doesn't know what they're saying. And finding out what they're saying and seeing what the result of that is takes us through all three books.
And Edward Carey does his own illustrations, but these are young adult novels or
yeah, older young adult novels.
Okay.
And as in many trilogies, as or many series of books, the books get a little bit darker as they go along. So I would say, from my perspective, the third one is much darker than Heap House.
All right. Edward Carey, Heap House. What's next?
Next is what I think is the most important and amazing novel of 2015. It's called The Sympathizer. It's by a Vietnamese writer who is now living in California teaching, Viet Thanh Nguyen. the sympathizer opens on the day that the United States is evacuating the embassy, their embassy in Saigon. And the main character in this book is a young South Vietnamese man who works as an adjutant to a high-up military officer in the South Vietnamese army. And so he is one of those who is going to be evacuated. He's on those helicopters. What we learn quite early, but what nobody in South Vietnam knows, especially the general he works for, is that he's really a spy for the North. So this is a book that operates on many levels. This is a really powerful spy novel. It's a powerful look at what it means to be an immigrant in the United States coming from South Vietnam, who, you know, let's remember, were welcomed immigrants, but what that's like to live through. And it's about friendship. It's about being different. It's about knowing who you are. It's a dark, dark satire. I think people who loved Catch-22 and want to change the locale, want to change the subject, but not that biting tone. The Sympathizer is just a major book. And I don't think we've had a book by a South Vietnamese writing both about the Vietnam War and fictionally about what it's like to come to America. Yeah. It's an amazing book. I have to say, it just gets stronger and stronger as it goes on. And the last chapter was one of the most painful reading experiences that I've ever had.
And you say nominally it's sort of a spy novel, but it's much, much more.
It is. Although, you know, when you think about spy novels, you kind of see how spy novels really encompass so much just in what they're about and how they deal with the world and the person who is chosen to be a spy. It's about, this is a book about betrayal. It's a book about friendship. And the writing is brilliant, but it's difficult because of the subject matter.
That's Via Tan Nguyen's The Sympathizer. What's next?
Next is a children's book for younger children. I'm thinking 7, 8. This book is fun to read to younger kids as well. It's by Carol Ryrie Brink, and she is the author who won the Newbery Award for Caddy Woodlawn, and that's what she's really known for. But she wrote many other books, and The Highly Trained Dogs, The Professor Petite, is one of my favorites, and this is one of my book crush rediscoveries. So The Highly Trained Dogs of Professor Petite is set in the middle of the 19th century in a small town, and a boy discovers, he's kind of decided to take some time off from working for his uncle for the day or an hour or two, and he meets Professor Petite and his highly trained dogs who are coming to do a big show in the town. And at the same time, another circus has come to town, is coming to town, and this other circus has a trained tiger who jumps through a hoop of fire. And then a crime is committed, and one of Professor Petite's dogs is the only being who knows what really happened. And he is trying to communicate who done it. And he's communicating it by using blocks because he can spell. You know, those wooden alphabet blocks that everybody's kids played with. Yes, it's a fabulous book.
Now, when did this book originally come out? How old is it?
It probably originally came out in the late 50s or early 60s.
Okay, so this is, this is sort of vintage baby boomer child gear here.
Right. And it's short and it's fun and you just, all good things happen in the end. It's just, for me, one of the perfect children's books.
All right, that's for the children. Carol Ryrie Brink's The Highly Trained Dogs of Professor Petite, which is one of Nancy's rediscoveries in her ongoing publishing mogul moguldom. Anyway, let's move on. What's up next?
Okay, next is Ruth Downey's Tabula Rasa. This is the sixth book in a historical mystery series set in Roman Britain. And this is one of those series where you don't have to read them in order. She really summarizes pretty much all that you need to know. I mean, if I were going to start with this, I would start with number one, in the series, which is called Medicus, M-E-D-I-C-U-S. The main character in this series is a medicus, is a physician, a Roman physician named Gaius Russo, who is married to a native British woman. So you get in these books that interesting contrast between, I hesitate to say highly civilized Rome, but you get this nice contrast between Russo and his view of the world and his wife, who is a very strong, wonderful character, and her view of the world. For me, the mysteries, what they're about, what happens, this is about a dead body that's found by Hadrian's Wall. Those are less interesting to me. The specifics of the mystery itself are less interesting to me than the setting and the kind of social milieu that she's writing about. They're great.
Are they really historically sort of accurate, or is it more of a flight of imagination?
No, I think they're historically accurate. Mm-hmm. You know, I think every writer takes some liberties, but I think that I certainly feel that she's done her research.
But it's the idea of this world she's created around these characters that's the most interesting part.
Yes.
My guest today is Nancy Pearl, our reviewer of books here on Studio Tulsa. We have a couple left. Crooked Heart by Lisa Evans.
Lissa. I think she pronounces it Lissa.
Lissa. Okay, Lissa Evans.
Lissa Evans is a British writer, very popular in Britain. This is the first novel of hers that's been published in America. Crooked Heart is set during World War II, during the Blitz, when German bombs were raining down on London, and the government ordered all the children in especially, you know, the highly susceptible areas to be evacuated. And that was mostly many kids from the East End of London. And there's lots of books about those kids and even TV shows.
Yeah, films, everything. Yeah, that's it's a well-documented story.
It is. But this is a quite different take on that. So one of the two main characters is a 10-year-old boy named Noel, who is evacuated and is assigned to live in a house with a woman named Vera and her somewhat mysterious adult son. Vera is one of those women who is kind of a con at heart. I mean, she is always coming up with these great ideas to separate people from their money. And the only problem that Vera has is that she's not a planner. She can't follow through. You know, she doesn't think things through. Well, it turns out that what Noel does best is think. And he is a planner. And the two of them are going off to make their fortune through various cons. What I loved about this book is the terrific relationship between 10-year-old Noel and adult Vera, and how they grow into this unlikely friendship. The writing is just, it's lovely writing. It's a wonderful story. The one problem that I had with this book, and you know, Rich, I very seldom talk about what I don't like or what I don't think worked in a book. But I have to say that what didn't work for me in this book is that there's a whole subplot with Vera's son and her son's fiancé. And I just did not see the point of having that in what is essentially a story of Noel and Vera. So I'm wondering, I'll probably never find out, but wondering what, you know, why Lissa Evans chose to include that.
And yet, despite that, you thought that the story was strong enough that it made the list.
Yes, and I have to say that the pages where the sun appeared, I just skimmed them. Because I wanted to get back to Vera and Noel to see what's happened to them. I wanted to spend more time with them.
Well, we have time for one more book. And, you know, when you give me the list ahead of time, I'm always looking for something I know something about. And this last book is one I do know because he was on the show earlier this year. Rinker Buck, who recreated a wagon train, not even a wagon train, just a wagon trip on the Oregon Trail. It's titled The Oregon Trail by Rinker Buck. What drew you to this particular book?
Well, you know, I love history, and so I'm always interested in that. And when I saw what the book was about, which, as you say, is about a man, grown man in his 50s, who decides that he is going to recreate the experience of those pioneers who left St. Joseph, Missouri and headed west in their mule-drawn carriages. I guess you wouldn't call them carriages, would you?
Wagons.
Wagons. They're mule-drawn wagons. And when then I started reading it, and then I saw that anyone who is missing Bill Bryson, you know, feeling that Bill Bryson is not writing fast enough to suit them with his very entertaining, often hilarious armchair travel books, that this is a perfect book for them. Every year there's one book that I think many different types of readers or people who are looking for different things in books would enjoy. And I think The Oregon Trail is one of those, because it's really, you learn so much about the experience of these pioneers as they, as their mules ambled west. You follow along, and one of the things that I loved is that he Rinkerbuck and his brother went by the cabin where Narcissa and Marcus Whitman lived, their homestead in Washington.
Yeah, no.
And if you go there, which I have been there, you can actually see the ruts from the wheels of their wagon that have been preserved in the ground by their homestead. But this book, I mean, there are, as you know, Rich, there are such funny parts in this book. I mean, when he describes what he packed originally for the trip, you know, a shoe shiner and, a special coffee maker, all his Calphalon pans, pots and pans, all of that. But then, you know, there's chapters where he goes off and talks about the introduction of mules to America, and
right.
I guess we have to thank George Washington for that.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating history, but what I really thought was interesting, you know, you would think the Oregon Trail, it's all private land now, but he could actually follow it, not on a highway next to the trail. He was on the trail.
Right.
Which, that blew me away.
Yes, and, I mean, didn't it make you want to just do that same trip? I mean, it made me want to do the same trip, but not with a covered wagon.
Exactly. A car would be fine at 70 miles an hour, not 10 miles a day. Anyway, that name of that last book is The Oregon Trail by Rinkerbuck, and I think your comparison is apropos, which is that if you love Bill Bryson, you're going to love this book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Happy holidays. Happy Thanksgiving to you, Nancy Pearl. You can see the list on our website. Nancy, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Rich.
Book reviewer Nancy Pearl sharing her latest list of recommended reading here with us today on Studio Tulsa. For the complete list of books, visit our website at publicradiotulsa.org and search for Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.